In Western Buddhism, there has come to be a couple different ways to think about meditation practice, partly because the systems that we have come up with that have become forms like insight meditation and others have been influenced by multiple streams of ancient practice. And in some ways, very different ideas about how practice unfolds. And the relationship of yoga as posture practice, breath practice, and meditation as an awareness or mindful practice, and the way that those have been separate communities, separate forces in the West is part of that. One of the main divisions in practice that we can start to identify that shows up subtly in how the meditation instructions or mindfulness instructions are different at different times from different teachers, is that we will hear an instruction to be aware of phenomena as they arise, like sensations or feelings, energies, pleasant and unpleasant, mind states, etc. To be aware of them without intervening at all, with a kind of neutral witness awareness. And sometimes this is called bare awareness or open awareness. And the heart of it is the position of the witness, this observing without intervening quality. And this is a profound meditative state, contemplative state. And in some traditions, it's thought of as the highest of the yogas. That kind of observation without fixing onto an object, without trying to control our experience at all or make it into something, is considered both the most refined meditation, for instance, in some Tibetan traditions, and also the hardest. And it's not a beginner's practice in many of the systems. But in some traditions, like Zen, it became the entire thing. And so even as a beginner, you'll be given that instruction. And that happens here as well. In insight meditation, very often, the instruction we're given, like for the breath, right away is, don't modify the breath, just let it do whatever it's doing, and just observe it without trying to change it. That's a great instruction, a beautiful instruction for cultivating equanimity and a spacious awareness that doesn't grasp. The trouble with that instruction is that it's hard, and that when we don't succeed at it, we very often simply reinforce deep habits that aren't necessarily useful. And so then the other wing of yogic practice that, and both of these show up in all the traditions, they show up in the yoga world, they show up in early Buddhism, they show up in later Buddhisms. The other wing of practice is doing things intentionally to change your state. Breathing more deeply, sitting up taller, right? These are not the instruction to just observe and be mindful without intervening. This is an instruction to intervene. And this instruction is exemplified by what we could call the seventh component of the Eightfold Path, which is the practice of effort, wise effort. The three final components of the path dealing with the meditative practice, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Sorry, effort is sixth, mindfulness is seventh, concentration eighth. Effort, mindfulness, and concentration speak to the assembly of the heart-mind in focused, balanced, energized presence. And the practice of effort is described as cultivating wholesome states and preventing unwholesome states. And it's an active practice, right? It says, if there's a wholesome state that hasn't arisen, invoke it. Like joy, one of the seven factors of enlightenment. If there's not joy present, find some. Right? But also, if there's not calm present, find some. So it really says, assess your experience and notice that if there are wholesome factors that are not present, cultivate them intentionally. Don't just observe in a neutral way. Likewise, if there are unwholesome factors present, to be blunt, get rid of them. And again, don't just observe them in a neutral way. So you could take You could take anger as a manifestation of a self-protective impulse, but that can spill out into hatred or judgment of ourselves or others. This is traditionally an unwholesome quality. The instruction for bare mindfulness and the instruction of right effort would then be opposites, right? One instruction says just observe it and accept it. It's a natural quality, that's true. The other says find its roots, uproot them, end this quality in the psyche. And this difference in instructions can be confusing for beginners. It can actually be confusing for non-beginners in practice, because you have to assess moment to moment, what's the right practice? Is the right thing for you in this moment to work on accepting all phenomena that arise without preference? That's a deep training in equanimity. Or is the right practice for you to actually tune your instrument, right? To shape your experience and say, oh, look, like ill will or hatred, self-hatred or judgment of myself or others has arisen. Stop it. Not in a judgmental like way that would just add more self-hatred to the mix, right? Like, oh, I hate myself for hating myself, right? So that's not useful. That's an endless regress. Oh, I hate myself for hating myself, for hating myself. But it says actually, and this can really come out of our practice of loving kindness, I notice the unwholesome state, and out of kindness for all concerned, myself, my partner who I might bark at, my kid, the earth that I impact and live on, the people I encounter, can I uproot this unwholesome quality from my being? And so one of the things that's powerful about the weave between the what I'll call the more active practices, like taking yoga postures or guiding the breath, deepening the breath, is that these are practices that sit on the doing side of the doing non-doing spectrum. Right? They say, if you're a little sleepy, brighten up. If you're a little restless, calm down or concentrate. If the mind is dispersed, gather it. Right? It also says, if most of what you're noticing is unpleasantness, if there's mostly complaint in your system, notice the pleasant. As in, turn your attention away from the thing that's grabbing your heart, the drama in your life that you can't stop thinking about. But that really, what your heart is saying over and over is, things are wrong, things are wrong, things are wrong. It has to be fixed, it has to be fixed. And that's a habit that comes from the nervous system trying to protect itself, but it's not actually protecting you, right? It's causing greater distress. And it's an unwholesome state. Anxiety is an unwholesome state. And so, using the active practices, we say, turn your attention away from that toward a wholesome state. So when I do physical practice and then entering into the stillness practice now, I very often begin with this thing that might be strange to some of you, which is to look around. This is a practice that comes from the trauma work that's growing in the Buddhist world right now. And what it is basically is a cheap trick for your nervous system, right? You're not really looking around. What you're doing is you're inviting your animal body to recognize that it's safe here. And so what it does is it takes me out of distraction, it brings me into the physical space through my senses, through the visual sense. And as a nice byproduct, the part of myself that might feel under threat is also logging where the doors are and the windows and who's here and if you're glaring at me and I should be afraid. Right? All of the subtle cues that we get that you're an animal, right? Like you're constantly assessing the environment, mostly unconsciously, for the clues of whether you're safe or not. And so one of the deepest things we can do to deepen in wholesome states is to give our bodies, our animal bodies, our nervous systems, the information they need to feel safe. Feeling safe is pleasurable. Pleasure gives rise to concentration and mindfulness and kindness and all of the other wholesome states. And without the feeling of safety, we can't land in meditation. right? You can't close your eyes and go inward if you're worrying about being hurt by the outside. And that's the gross level version of it. But of course, this is true on so many subtle levels. If I'm trying to settle the heart into deep intimacy with the present moment, but my mind keeps going, you know, call Aunt Marge, call Aunt Marge. Remember to call. That was a terrible conversation. You must fix it. You must do something. Oh my God, that thing he said, it's so bad. Wait, my emails. Like, if the mind is doing that, there's no way to settle. In the observe without doing anything model, the teaching is that if we just notice that and come back to the present, that action alone will let it subside. And I think that it can for some people. That coming back to the present can be a form of reminding the body, mind, that I'm safe here, and that the obsessive thought is not actually killing me in this moment. But for a lot of us, what that does is it kind of just doesn't deal with it in a certain way. And I say this again coming from the information about the nervous system and trauma. I want to suggest that the unwholesome states that include the wandering mind, distraction in meditation, anxiety, obsessive thought, difficult or unpleasant emotion, harmful emotion, so like ill will, harmful, grief, not harmful, even though it may be unpleasant, so really knowing what's wholesome and what's unwholesome in terms of feeling, but the unwholesome feelings and the states, I want to propose that these are not random bubblings up of consciousness just to be observed in a neutral way. I want to propose that these are the nervous system saying that it doesn't feel safe. And that in some way, anxious thought is the animal being going, I'm afraid of the future, I'm afraid of the future, I'm afraid of the future. Which means that it's not a random arising, it's actually a sign that there is a dis-ease, a non-resting in the body right now. And because of that, I think the active practices for many people can be more effective quicker than neutral observation. The baseline of our whole practice is open observation, but getting to that, being able to do that successfully, requires a wholesome state. So I teach now that the open awareness practices, the wide open non-judgmental practices, are actually a step in practice or a phase in practice that comes after a fair amount of stabilization. Only when I can rest at ease in contact with some amount of pleasure and the feeling of safety can I then take my hands off the wheel, because I know that taking my hands off the wheel and allowing my system to fluctuate and just observe, I'm not going to just land in the ditch of obsessive negativity. Until I'm ready for it, that practice can be destabilizing. When I'm ready for it, it's the most liberating thing. And it's actually the thing that has to happen eventually for liberation to unfold. Right? You can't just control your experience for the rest of your life. I know you're trying. Perhaps it will fail. But as we learn to tune our practice, what we learn is that when there's unwholesome states and energetic challenge, it can be very helpful, once we notice that they're there, to shape our experience in the direction of positive affect or pleasantness, brightening of energy, but essentially balancing of energy, and then deeper focus. Once I can sustain presence with the pleasant and the easeful, then there's a slope toward letting go of effort more and more and more and more and more until there's a resting. And that resting ultimately includes everything. It means I can fluctuate through pleasant and painful, through gain and loss, all of the comings and goings that are part of impermanence. So then the yoga practice starts with, take this shape, breathe this way, deepen the breath, hold the breath, reach out really long. And doing all of that, it's like I focus and I gather my energies and I I align them. But that can't be the end of practice, right? Otherwise, I'm essentially learning military drills. And an injury and age and the fluctuating of the body is eventually going to disrupt that clarity anyway. But I start there, and then from that clarity, then there's this feeling. This is why I really encourage noticing how your state shifts in practice. I start a little bit dispersed, I gather my energy, and then it's gathered. And I think from that place of a somewhat gathered energy and a groundedness, that's where the traditional instructions often start. Right? When the Buddha tells people to meditate, you know, in the early texts, the instructions are really, very simple, perhaps disheartening. You know, they say things like this. Find an empty spot, sit down, cross your legs, assemble mindfulness, direct it to the breath, stabilize the attention with the breath, and then dissolve pleasure into the whole body. And I'm like, okay, that's it? What about the 20 years I spent, like putting together an ego structure and learning how to not hate myself and dealing with, you know, obsessive distraction? None of that is in the texts. Because they assume you've already got that. And so how do we get that? Right? We train in stability and actually coming out of the trance of distress. We do this intentionally, noticing wholesome states and breathing into them, letting them expand. Get the body more comfortable, get the mind more comfortable. And if the body is injured in a way that comfort is never available, find the best comfort you can. Right? The way you said, too much sitting doesn't really work, walk in nature. I'm like, yeah, do that. And don't think that that is a prelude to sitting in meditation, as if sitting meditation is better, right? It's more like, no, that's what you need to do to find the wholesome state. Once you have a wholesome state, then deepen from there. In whatever way. The whole practice suggests wholesome states give rise to stability. Stability gives rise to clear seeing. And clear seeing gives rise to liberation. And so we have to get on that path in whatever way is possible. So as you practice then, just the encouragement to be curious about, as your practice unfolds, when is it appropriate to notice your state and actually adjust it toward a more wholesome state? And when is it appropriate to notice it and let go? And I'll say just kind of one more thing about that assessment, and then here's some questions. When I notice my state and it's unpleasant, and I have the sense that taking my hands off the wheel and just observing it is going to lead to essentially the unpleasantness continuing and maybe even worsening or spinning or complexifying, that's a moment to say, put my hands back on the wheel. If I have the sense that taking my hands off the wheel and just observing in a neutral way, the pleasant unpleasant is good, is in its natural flow. It's like, yeah, it's a little unpleasant right now. It's going to turn around. In other words, I'm not too messed up about it, or I don't like, that's the wrong term, messed up. I'm not out of balance in relation to it. Then, rest at ease, because pleasant and unpleasant fluctuates as part of existence, right? First Noble Truth. So, the sense in assessing whether it's right to be in an open witness or a guiding my state kind of practice is really whether there's enough basic balance and ease in my system to allow more. The less balance and ease, or the more chaotic my system, the more deeply habituated the attention or focus on danger is, the more I'll need to contain and guide my system for a while. I think this is partly why open awareness meditation, the heart of, say, Soto Zen, has become kind of yay popular in the States. But standing in rows at attention and putting yourself through military drill yoga has become yay popular, like tremendously popular, because a huge amount of us, I think, need that structure and containment for a very long time at first. And mostly because this is Spirit Rock and I can say this, I'll suggest that that's good up to a point, but at a certain point it has to be let go of and come into a more open space. And so then, as your practice matures, it's going to be up to you, really, to play with the spectrum between ordered and constraining practice, and then wide open, fluctuating, let itself do itself kind of practice. And that'll be true both in asana and in the stillness meditation practices. Any thoughts or questions here?
I am very new to all of this, and probably started this sort of general journey through yoga, which is what brought me here to this class at Spirit Rock. And my question is that I have found personally that I can enter a yoga practice, it can be a gentle one or a very active one, and yet not really go through what I've learned as the rain process. Not truly recognizing, acknowledging, investigating what happened, what might be really going on, even though my body is more loose and I might feel more general ease of mind after yoga. So my question is, I'm wondering, in what you're suggesting, do we perhaps first need to go through a little bit of that recognition, acknowledgement, investigation of what's going on with us? A little bit before we might enter the more structured practice? Hopefully I'm being clear of what I'm saying.
What I hear, and I think it's a really good question, is it's a little bit like, here's this structured practice that changes my state in a certain way. It brightens my energy, whatever. Mm-hmm. How do I even know whether that's the right thing to do? I might need to do a little, you're using the RAIN model. This is a model for a kind of clear, often useful in like emotional settings, mindfulness, recognize what's happening, accept it, meaning don't be in denial, don't resist it, investigate it, get curious, feel it, be intimate with it, and then the N is non-identification, like see if you can observe it in a clear way without getting too tangled up in its meaning. And this is a beautiful model. This is a modern model for mindfulness that's tremendously useful. And part of what I hear you suggesting is it might be that you use that practice a little bit, and I'll suggest that practice just becomes habituated and it's always present in you through your whole life. Mm-hmm. Like you always are aware of what's happening and you're always accepting. Doesn't mean I'm not going to change it, but it means I accept that it's here now. Like, oh look, I'm pissed, right? Acceptance means saying to myself, oh look, I'm pissed, rather than being like, why that whoever, president, you know, whatever. I wasn't going to go there. You know, rather than blaming it on someone else, acceptance says, this is my state right now. I'm pissed. Investigation means like, what's really going on? Non-identification means like, oh, this is a product of conditions. I have to do that all the time. And so then that, especially the recognition and investigation pieces, are part of assessing what's the right practice for you today. So rather than having the habit, every morning at 9 I go to vinyasa class, or every morning at 6 I sit in meditation, those are fine if you need time, discipline, structure in order to order your life. That's good. But I'll suggest that a next step as mature practitioners, even beginning mature practitioners, is to say, oh look, it's 5:45. Is sitting in meditation the right thing for me this morning? Or would going for a walk be the right thing? Or staying in bed, right? What would give me this, what would condition the state that's going to be most useful for me? Clarity, brightness. Very often, meditation is wonderful for clarity and brightness, but not always. Likewise, is it the right thing to go to my vigorous vinyasa class today? And you know, maybe going there out of habit, whether I want to or not, is a good practice for discipline, but I think a deeper step is to say, is that actually going to cultivate the state that's right for me today? So I have a little bit of rain, and I do some cultivating, and I want to keep that awareness on, active, all the way through the practice. So like I've been halfway through a strong practice before, and been like, oh, you know, that's enough strong practice for me. And I'm now actually shifting into a recognition that going more gently is right for me. And I'll go from like breathing hard and reaching out to the very tips of my cells to like softening everything and becoming like the floppy yogi in class. And then, and I give you full permission to do this whether your teacher wants you to or not, I'll just not do things. Like I've just like, phew, like taken an early landing in class, and I start to do sitting poses, and you might be in the back if that's your thing, or check in with your teacher, of course. Don't be socially insensitive, but be willing to follow your thread and be like, oh, my system is settling down, and then really knowing that that's right. Something like that. Yeah. Other thoughts?
I'm going to make a comment. It's like Thich Nhat Hanh has a model that I've read a couple of times, I'll paraphrase it. He says, you know, we all have the garden, and you know, we have the beautiful plants, and we've got the evil plants.
Yeah.
And the idea is when the evil plants, when you're, I think what you're saying is trying to, you know, make yourself more wholesome, that path, not guys took into that. But it's sort of like, you know, don't nurture the evil paths. Like when you get angry at somebody, don't nurture that anger. And he just had a model that I took it as just kind of put the evil plants back in the core of the garden where they don't get a lot of sunshine, they don't get a lot of water, and then really try to make room for the beautiful, wholesome plant thoughts.
Absolutely.
Is that kind of where you're going?
It's totally where I'm going.
Because I'm trying to envision how do you create your mindscape sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and here I'll make a distinction then. The garden metaphor is beautiful, right? So you're tending your garden. Of course, you're going to pull up the weeds and water the tomatoes or, you know, whatever your preference is. There's a beautiful definition of weeds from the permaculture world, which says that a weed is just any plant you didn't choose, right? That you didn't prefer there. One person's weed is another person's, you know, rarity. But I'll say that, like, growing a garden is one phase of spiritual practice, right? There's another phase that's called wilderness. So like in my garden, I want certain plants and not others. But out in the woods, I'm not going to go and try to pull up all the poison oak and make the woods comfortable for me. That's an illusion that I could somehow change the whole external world to be like cozy. And so I think the open awareness practice, the open witnessing practice, the hands off the wheel practice is actually a very deep practice. That's why it's the most advanced, of not having a perfect garden, but becoming wild again. The trouble with becoming wild is that you have to actually be okay with wasps and, you know, other gnarly entities in your garden, poison oak, you know. And I think you find this in some really wise, you know, old people who are kind of over the whole game. They're over sexual attraction, they're over making money, they're over pleasing anybody, they're kind of just like themselves. They've become wild again. And there's poison oak and there's weeds and it's just like, yep, you know, what did you expect out of this human life? And that's a different layer of wisdom. And I think it's developmentally appropriate, it's age appropriate in different ways. It's socially appropriate in different contexts to do that. I think for many of us, we might think that we're ready for that when actually what we're doing is we're just indulging old habits. And pretty much every practitioner I know would do better to focus on cultivating the garden than rewilding. And over time, start to, in a sense, learn how to garden in a wilder way. How to make space for the unwanted plants without thinking that you could possibly uproot them all and have a pristine, you know, Garden of Versailles kind of sculpted inner life. Yeah, so we have to do a bit of both. Cultivate the good, diminish the harmful, and at the same time know that this is a wild ecosystem that can't actually be tamed by any effort, you know, and that even the Buddha, the liberated ones, are exemplars of what happens when you balance cultivation and letting go, and what could be the result of that. Any other thoughts, and then we'll close for the day. One more, please.
I'm curious, I need maybe for you to help define putting your hands on the wheel as opposed to just opening to what arises. For example, like say you're in a situation where you feel irritated at something, mm-hmm. or angry or something, and that is a not wholesome state, as you would say.
Yeah.
And if you were, well, I don't know, you can't just immediately go into meditation, but
right.
you're saying to kind of not just recognize it and say, oh,
yeah.
anger is arising,
right.
but to go beyond that,
yeah.
would you try to, I'm not, flip it and go back to a gratitude list, so to speak, which always helps
right.
when you get into an unwholesome.
You could do that. I would call that an emergency method. I would call that like an emergency break. You know.
What would you suggest doing other than observing if you're in a
yeah.
State where you're annoyed or you know not horrible but
totally.
Where you're irritated?
What putting your hands back on the wheel might look like in a moment like that is gathering my attention and consciously assessing my immediate safety. So like, here we are disagreeing, we are not, but here I am disagreeing with the invisible, difficult person. And first, I'm gonna remove myself slightly, you know, and I'm gonna be like, okay, this is happening. That's recognition and acceptance. And then the active part of that is gonna be, okay, what can I do in this moment to both end the discord and regain space. In other words, do I have to keep arguing? Almost never, unless I'm in immediate danger. So then my practice is going to be like, okay, I see myself trying to win the argument, stop. And I'm just going to be like, you know, thanks for talking, I'm not going to go on, see you tomorrow. And I'm leaving. And just like step back, if I can. That's not always possible. But I'm going to take an active step to restore safety and equilibrium and end the trigger that's going to continue the discord. And then once I'm not engaged in essentially self-defense, then my practice is going to be, again, not just to accept, because often that just means I'm going to run through the story in my mind, re-amplifying it. I'm actually going to concentrate, and I'm going to bring my attention into the present, into the environment, and into something that feels more at ease. I'm going to walk, perhaps. I'm going to see what's around me. I'm going to feel the heat and vibration in my body, and I'm going to really intentionally allow the body to express, like just to feel, while keeping my attention rooted in the present and out of story. And so hands on the wheel mostly means directed attention, right? Consciously give my attention to something rather than letting it be wide open, which is going to usually mean spinning thought. It's very hard to be mindful of spinning thought. So get out of it is the hands on the wheel instruction. So attention to my body, but also attention to the space, get out of the immediate trigger, and the body's going to chill out. Right? As soon as I'm not triggering it anymore, the nervous system is going to settle. And as it settles, the investigation and non-identification pieces can come in. Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for asking. All right. So, again, thank you for being here. It's really a pleasure to come up and teach for Ashley this morning. She's well. She'll be back next week. And I'm down in Oakland and Berkeley. You can find me down there. I'm teaching a retreat in January, the 3rd to the 10th, down in the Santa Cruz Redwoods, integrating yoga and meditation practice. And I have a Tuesday night sitting group at Namaste Yoga in West Berkeley. You're all welcome to, of course, if the East Bay is part of your circuit. And I'll just wish everyone well this morning, and blessings in your practice.